Hello, welcome back to Scottish Independence Podcasts. Fiona and Marlene here, and we've got something slightly different for you this week. It's just me and Marlene in the studio chatting with a few clips put in as well.
Hello, I'm here. I am here too. We were just going to have a little bit of a chat about how we think the first year has gone for Humza Yousaf, our new leader of the SNP and First Minister for a year. So we've got some thoughts on the subject, haven't we?
We have, and we also have some clips to illustrate the discussion as well, because we have been collecting them knowing this discussion was coming up. So hope you'll enjoy this.
Here we go.
Thank you, Presiding Officer. Just a few weeks ago, I couldn't have imagined that I'd be standing here as First Minister, setting out the policy priorities and indeed the defining missions of the government that I lead. Being First Minister is, of course, not without its challenges, it's fair to say, but notwithstanding that, it is, of course, the honour of my life. And in my very first speech to this chamber after the result was announced, I made it clear that the people of Scotland's priorities will, of course, be my priorities too. And I've been clear from the outset that I intend on governing in the interests of the whole of Scotland. And I hope that today's policy prospectus that has been published is a demonstration of that.
When I was reflecting on Humza's first year in the role, it doesn't feel as if there's a Nicola Sturgeon-shaped gap in the Parliament, which suggests that Humza has actually stepped into the role and is making it his own.
Yes, and I think also because the
name she's still there.
She's sitting up on the back, but she's not doing a Boris Johnson or a Liz Truss and going out and earning thousands and thousands and thousands of quid, making contentious remarks about what he's doing in the way that they have. So in a way, she has tipped back to give him the stage, of course, which is what you'd want, really.
Yeah.
I suppose also we will know what his priorities are when we see the SNP manifesto for the general election. That's going to give us quite an indication of where he'd like to take the party. And I get the impression he works in a team rather than I'm the leader and that's what we're doing.
The things I had on my what went well, first of all, I thought walking into a leadership job and then the whole Gaza thing blowing up in his face when it affected his own family, I thought the stance he took there was really leadership. And it made him look like a statesman, actually, rather than a politician. And it seemed to be very heartfelt, but also very measured in that people have been killed on both sides.
Exactly. And he was very clear about that, you know, what Hamas did was an atrocity. I noticed when he was talking to James O'Brien, James O'Brien at one point asked him about, you know, that whole involvement of his family being there and what that was like and everything.
We didn't say anything for the first couple of days.
No.
It's such a difficult issue to speak about publicly in the sense that, you know, my in-laws, we know Gaza was under control of Hamas. So if we, and of course there was no question of me criticising Hamas for and condemning their abhorrent terror attack on October 7th, but I also knew that that could have an impact on them and their family. They could be targets. You know, we know Hamas don't take kindly to people speaking against them. And if they could get to my in-laws or get to my brother-in-law, for example, or any of the wider family, they could really be made an example of. So there was that consideration. And then there was a consideration as well about actually, if you criticise the actions of the Israeli government, which again, to me, there was no question of doing, given the amount of civilian bodies that were piling up, continued to do to this day, then actually maybe we'll never get them out, because getting them out would require, I suspect, some cooperation with the Israeli government through the official channels. So there was always that consideration, but to be honest, after a couple of days, it was very, very clear that they were trapped and they were stuck and we had to raise their voice. And actually, it was my mother-in-law who said, you need to tell the world what's happening. Like she was describing the devastation and destruction in the first few days and said, the world has to know what's happening, Humza.
Quite something to situation to suddenly find himself and have to cope with. Very complex.
And to have to, at the same time, deal with all the nonsense that goes goes along with being, well, being First Minister and dealing with whatever Douglas Ross throws at him at FMQs while this whole thing is going, you just can't imagine it.
So what do you think of him at FMQs then?
That's on my not quite so good list,
okay,
I have to say, because I think he goes on too long. And in fact, the presiding officer actually switched his microphone off because he just wouldn't stop speaking.
Briefly, First Minister.
And that is why, of course, is imperative throughout all of these challenges that governments and political parties make a decision. Do they invest in public services?
Thank you, First Minister. We must move on to the next question. First Minister.
Is it?
First Minister. First Minister, I have asked that you conclude your question. I am now moving on to the next question.
On the one hand, he's never stuck for words, but you kind of end up switching off a bit, I think, when it goes too long.
I think that's true. And I saw that clip, and then he got asked a question by a thingy called Hamilton.
To ask the First Minister when the Cabinet will next meet.
First Minister.
Tuesday.
it was quite funny. You know, there was an element of the sulky schoolboy there, I thought.
He's just got a different style. I mean, what I notice now is that there's three male party leaders, and I think that has changed the tone somewhere. I think there's more belligerence. I mean, I'm not putting it all down to Humza, but I think he does kind of get involved in that a little bit more than maybe he needs to. And the one thing I just, you know, thought that Nicola Sturgeon was brilliant at was First Minister's questions, because she was always on top of the facts, and then she'd use them to make a kind of, she pulled the rug out from under them, because she was so kind of quick, and she could get in and out and
turn it round and make
turn
the point
it round
on them,
quite quick and remember what they said, you know, 6 months back. Or he's not as good as that, and he's not as light on his feet in that sort of way. But, you know, it's also true that she'd been doing the job for a long time. I find his style a little bit too kind of cumbersome.
I agree, and maybe it'll come with experience, but she is very good at using humour.
Yes,
and not only
exactly.
does that moves you away from that belligerence, which he kind of sometimes gets drawn into, but it also makes your point really beautifully well. And I think Humza is, he's still more sort of, here are all the facts and I will go through them and make sure my answer covers everything, by which time you're sort of getting on, get on with it.
I think something that's a bit telling about that is, if you're looking for a GIF or a meme, a GIF or something, there's and you put in Nicola Sturgeon, there's umpteen of her come, and they're usually just little moments, often when she's doing PMQs, and she's just standing there and she's just got a wee MP grin on her face, or an eyebrow. And I think that's actually quite telling, because that was often how she'd make the best point, really. Anyway, that's a bit of advice for Humza.
I was really interested in the discussion with James O'Brien about his home influences, and the fact his mother had been a really strong character, and this idea that it was a very political family upbringing anyway.
My dad, he was clearly a black sheep politically growing up, because he would get abused for the fact that he was an SNP supporter.
This
and
is
a member
fascinating.
Of the Asian
Where did
community.
That come from?
So when you were an Asian migrant in particular, you always voted Labour. Mm. That was it. It was a dumb thing. No ifs, no buts, no maybes. Labour was the party of the immigrant. And the SNP, very unfairly, was being equated with the kind of far right. Mm. You know, they were saying, look, once they get their independence, they'll chuck you out. But my dad says that he was surprised, shocked, in fact, the day he was told Scotland wasn't an independent country. Once he realised they're part of the UK, he was like, what? What on earth? It's dreadful. Why? And so he joined the SNP quite young in the 1970s. And mum was a Labour supporter, staunch Labour supporter. And you'd have this, you know, 1997 election, which is one of the earliest memories I have of an election, was dad's SNP poster in the top window and mum's Labour poster in the downstairs, and going, like, are you guys getting divorced? And they're like, no, we just support different political parties. So look, the life, I was lucky. I was really privileged. But mum in particular, one of the seminal moments for me was, you know, a court case for my mum, where she wanted to view a house in the suburbs just outside of Glasgow. And she kept trying to view this house and told there's no appointments available, the owner's away on holiday. And so my dad's white secretary then phones up and gets an appointment like this overnight.
And so they told you this story, did they?
Well, not only told us that, my mum decided to sue the estate and take them to court and eventually won. And to us, that was amazing. We were going, you know, why did you do that? Because the abuse we got, this is before social media, of course, but the letters we got through the door, hate-filled hate mail, literally hate mail that was pushed through the door. The stuff that, you know, I got at school for it. But Mum said, this is, you know, we do not take this lying down. Because Mum was so strong, robust, forthright about it, we're like, yeah, go Mum. You should absolutely be doing this.
Sounds like quite a political home then.
Yeah, political. Even though Dad was not, you know, he was in the SNP and he would take us out leafleting. He was never one to say you've got to join political party or get involved in politics. But look, anybody that you've ever had or spoken to that's been from the subcontinent, any family gathering quickly descends into politics. So we've been quite political, I think, as a people.
A Labour kind of poster on one window and an SNP poster on another window. That was brilliant.
He dealt as well quite nicely with the kind of criticism that you hear about, you know, career politicians, people who've done politics at university and then become politicians. And, well, what else have you done?
We talked earlier on about how inherently political my family was. And it was all, and I mentioned the fact my mum always said, look, if you want to change something, we'll change it. And you see something wrong, go do something about it. And to me, politics, the study of politics, not that I always wanted to be a frontline politician, far from it, actually. I was decent, as I said to you, kind of English. And I always thought of myself as maybe somebody doing some research or writing speeches, a little bit more in the background. And I thought, well, that's a good way to influence things.
I'm fascinated by the contrast that you represent between the criticism of people for being political animals all their life, like never had a quotes proper job end quotes, but under your analysis there is no more proper job than politics. So to go straight from graduating essentially into the party machine was a mark of your desire to actually start making changes. It's odd, I've never thought of that before, there's something a bit silly about saying why would you want to go straight into politics? Why wouldn't you want to go off and be a chartered surveyor for 10 years or write a newspaper column or something like that?
Yeah, I never got it, honestly.
I've only just seen it like this today.
I never got that argument because for a few reasons. First of all, you should never have a parliament that's not got people, I think, in their 20s or 30s represented, right? Because how else will the body politic understand what 20 and 30-year-olds want, need, desire, what their views are? But secondly, and I've been around politics for quite a while, just because you were a used car salesman for 15 years or just because you've done that job doesn't mean that you know everything about, for example, how the National Health Service should be run or how the justice system or the prison system should be run. But there's nothing wrong with having lots of experience in various different professions. But ultimately, the job of a minister, ultimately the job of the First Minister and Prime Minister, it's got to be to take advice from the experts. And that's become a dirty word in recent years. But you've got to be able to take advice from the experts and then apply your judgment and make a decision on what the best way and the best course forward is. And that doesn't really matter if you're, really, as I say, a brain surgeon or a used car salesman.
About politics as a profession.
Yes.
Which has become quite unfashionable in recent years for reasons.
We wouldn't dismiss anybody in any other profession having studied that profession before going into it.
No, we wouldn't.
The way he described his home life, it was much more, this is a conviction, this is the way we are, not this is my thought out career plan that I'm going to do this, this and this. I felt it made me think he had more substance as a person.
Yeah, and it was interesting when he said his mum might have had a few more doubts about when he said he was going to study politics at uni and not law. But his dad said...
And Dad always said to me, he always said, whatever you study makes you passionate about it and you love it because then doors will open for you. Mm. Like whatever you choose, doesn't matter what it is, as long as you genuinely, your heart's in it, don't do something you're being forced into, son. Do something that you're going to love, because then your opportunity will open. And he was dead right about it. So no, to me, politics was the obvious place to go.
The interview he did at the London School of Economics, I thought he was fabulous in the second half of that interview. The first half was going over a lot of ground that we're familiar with. But in the second half, suddenly he was talking about Scotland and things that were going on that I didn't know anything about.
In particular, a success story that I'm very keen has heard here in London, right across Europe, the United States and elsewhere. And that success that we're driving forward with is new high-growth tech firms. Companies such as Blackford Analysis, which uses the power of artificial intelligence to improve patient outcomes. Intelligence Growth Solutions, a company whose approach to precision farming is at the very forefront of the push to deliver global food security. Through our TechScaler network, of startup incubators, we're well on our way to delivering one of the finest state-funded systems in Europe dedicated to entrepreneurialism and dedicated to the creation of high-growth businesses. The programme is a game-changer for our startup community, and it's rapidly accumulated over 500 member companies. We've just opened our first tech-scaler hub in Silicon Valley to help promising startups from Scotland build contacts with international investors and customers. And there's a key point here that I want to stress. The exceptional entrepreneurial activity taking place in Scotland, backed by Scottish Government funding, is happening alongside, hand in glove, I would suggest, with a commitment to building a fairer society. To me, they are two sides of the same coin.
Some really good stuff to say as well about our GDP compared to the UK's as well, which I wasn't aware of.
Since 2007, when my party first came into power, GDP per person has grown by 10.8% in Scotland. That's compared to 5.6% in the UK. Productivity, while still not growing at the rate we'd like, has grown at an annual average rate of 1% a year compared with the UK government's 0.5% a year. Just yesterday, a key survey showed that private sector employment growth in Scotland last month was faster than any other region and nation in the UK.
We take for granted that people in Scotland know some of these things. Do we know them? Because there's so much negative publicity. It far outweighs anything positive that you ever hear about anything coming out.
I think that's true. And although you sort of said there was quite a lot in that first half of that talk he did at the LSE that we are familiar with. But that just gets back to the question you've just said. Who's familiar with it? You and I probably are. And, you know, folk are quite active in the, yes, we probably are, because we go and we look elsewhere, because by this time we just know that mainstream media are not going to give us a whole story, you know. So we keep up to date with blogs like, you know, John Robertson's one, Talking of Scotland. But I thought that first half of that talk, actually, I just thought it was just structured really well. You know, first of all, he goes about, so he's talking at the London School of Economics, right? So of course he's going to home in on economics. And you get a bit about the UK economy has failed, and a failed and failing UK economy, and he goes into a bit about that.
It's even been argued the UK economic performance has been so poor it is now completely decoupled from the economic development path of other wealthy comparator countries. Indeed, the Shadow Chancellor has said she will inherit the worst economic conditions of any incoming UK government since the Second World War. And as an aside, I have to say that is a far cry from the future that was promised to Scotland by those who opposed independence in 2014. Back then, it was the alleged strength of the UK economy that was trumpeted at the time. 10 years on, a decade later, and that talk instead from those very same people is of complete UK economic catastrophe and carnage. As I say, the UK economy is characterised by low growth. We know that. It fell into recession last year. Real wages have been stagnant. Inequality is far too high. Productivity growth, the key driver of living standards, has been poor. Business investment is low. Public capital investment has also been both low and, indeed, volatile. And as so many have highlighted, the UK displays a remarkable, persistent level of geographical inequality, with an unhealthy and unstable reliance on this wonderful city, but on the city of London. This all supports the conclusion of analysis that had been published in the Financial Times, which describes the UK as a poor society with pockets of rich people.
I just thought that was, I don't really touched me actually, a poor country with pockets of rich people. And then, you know, and then he goes on to go talk about, you know, yeah, of course, he and the SNP think that, well, Scotland's future should be decided by Scotland. And then he goes into another few facts. So there's, you know, he takes on Brexit and the way that, not so much the fact of it, but the way that Westminster dealt with it.
Amongst Westminster-based parties, there is a consensus that the UK should stay both out of the EU and the huge European single market, whatever the cost. The National Institute for Economic and Social Research suggests that compared to EU membership, the UK economy was 2.5% smaller in 2023 and expects that figure to rise to 5.7% in a little more than 10 years' time. That means $69 billion could have been wiped from national income in 2023. That equates to around about £28 billion in tax revenue, a population share for Scotland of £2.3 billion, and around 60% of spending in Scotland is on devolved services. So if you take the same level of borrowing, same level of taxation, that means without Brexit, devolved spending power for vital public services such as the NHS could have been £1.6 billion higher in Scotland than it is today. So in other words, we have suffered, our institutions have suffered, our public services have suffered, and ultimately our people have suffered to the tune of £1.6 billion that could have been invested in Scottish public services because of a Brexit that, remember, Scotland overwhelmingly rejected. So looking to the future, the Office for Budget Responsibility says that the UK's potential GDP is expected to fall by 4% in the long run because of Brexit. As Professor Anton Muscatelli, he's an economist and also the principal of the University of Glasgow, said such a GDP reduction has a massive impact on either funding public services or cutting taxes, depending on your political inclination. So in Scotland, in contrast with the view at Westminster, I believe that there is a broad agreement that Brexit has damaged the economy, damaged public services, and that it should be reversed.
He talks about public investment and the kind of assumptions that Labour and Conservatives make compared to the kind of assumptions that we'd want to happen up in Scotland. I mean, not just by the SNP. I mean, I suspect that Scottish Labour would want more public investment as well. And I was really quite riveted by it. And then there was another one that he came up to, which kind of, I took it as summarising what he'd like the Scottish government, the SNP, but Scottish government to be kind of striving up for in principle was...
with a bold policy platform that says economic dynamism and social solidarity absolutely go hand in hand. If we do that, then we can create that growing, fairer, greener economy that will ensure greater prosperity for all of our people.
I just thought that was brilliant. Economic dynamism alongside social solidarity. That, particularly the word solidarity, actually. I'm hoping that goes on their manifesto.
So I think he can be extremely good at talking about positive things. And I think perhaps he gets a more balanced reception outside of Scotland.
Yeah.
Apart from, I mean, a couple of the questions that the media folk threw in were rubbish, and we're not going to bother covering that.
You listen to him, you think, yeah, they're trying to get that to be a little chunk in somebody's newspaper.
He didn't do quite so well, I don't think, when he was up against Martin Geisler. And he was okay when he was talking about the positive stuff. I didn't feel he was quite so fleet of foot when he was dealing with a few more, let's call them attack lines, but with a bit more understanding behind them. And Martin, I think, actually, of the BBC guys, is not the worst by any means.
You've slumped in the polls. You've got rid of key policies. Cancer waiting times have gone up. There's trouble in schools. Drug deaths are on the rise again after some progress. And you've fallen out with our local authorities. If you look at it like that, it's not a great report card, is it?
Well, not only have we reset the business relationship, so the New Deal for Business, we also, of course, signed the Verity House Agreement, which reset our relationship
and then immediately
with local
broke
authorities.
It.
And, of course, despite all of the challenges you mentioned, we, of course, continue, by most polls, to be ahead of our opponents. In fact, some polls even show that gap is widening. So I'm not complacent.
But then Martin Geisler, at the end, he kind of threw him a question that would have let him come up with a jokey, humorous ending.
Stephen Flynn has said that the camper van at the centre of all of this should be released from police custody and given to the Tartan Army to enable some of them to offset the expensive price of German hotels during the European Football Championships. Do you think the camper van should be given to Scottish football fans this summer?
And he offered it to Humza to kind of respond in a similar vein, and they would have finished on a lighter note. And Humza didn't. He just said,
I'm not going to get into a live police investigation. If you want to ask Stephen about his comments, feel free to bring Stephen on your programme.
You know, it was an opportunity missed.
So maybe that's another just kind of example. He's not like quite fleet of foot enough at the moment, but he'll get, I expect he'll he'll get there. I mean, one of the things I picked up on from the LSE event was how often he, in answer to questions, this is questions from the audience who are mainly students at LSE, and he often would get the question and he'd start talking about how you look for shared solutions, how you work with people on shared problems to try and find, you know, shared solutions. And there was one question from an Irish chap, and he was picking up on Humza had mentioned, you know, Ireland.
Well, could you talk maybe a little bit more about how you think you could work with Ireland in the future? So both outside the EU and then, well, if EU membership were to ever happen, what kind of partnership do you foresee with Ireland in the future?
Look, Ireland is going to always be an extremely close ally, whether we're part of the United Kingdom or indeed independent. We have good relationships with Ireland, ones that we want to continue to strengthen. But we'd like to do that as equal partners, not as part of the UK, but actually as an independent nation in its own right. And we engage just now with Ireland through, for example, the British-Irish Council. I'd love that to be the British-Irish-Scottish Council in years to come. There's many areas that we can work closely on. Some of those are trying to find shared solutions to shared problems. So I don't need to tell you or anybody, I suspect, that Ireland is facing some significant challenges in Dublin around housing, especially. Now, in Scotland, we also face some housing challenges. There's no doubt. We've had to make really difficult decisions around our own housing budget recently. So how do we get shared solutions, modern methods of construction, looking at modular construction? How do we put our heads together to work on common solutions to common challenges? And then there's areas of, I think one of the biggest areas of collaboration with Ireland will undoubtedly be on the renewable energy piece. Scotland and Ireland, probably alongside Norway, could effectively be the solution to the European Union and European countries, other European countries' problems and challenges around its over-reliance on foreign imports of gas, particularly Russian gas. But I think Ireland and Scotland collaborating together on that is a great idea.
Oh, wow. You know, that's a vision, isn't it? And it's not often you kind of hear that sort of more visionary kind of outlook. Well, I'm saying visionary. He was actually saying it would be a job of work and you'd do it. But that was great. I just thought that was brilliant. I had heard somewhere else that he'd written to Starmer.
I don't think necessarily that there'll be any question of a need for a formal cooperation agreement with the Labour Party, because I suspect its polls indicate Keir Starmer will win and win big. What I would say, though, to Keir Starmer is work with the Scottish Government where it's in the mutual interest to do so. So I wrote to Keir Starmer at the end of January. I said, look, let's talk about tackling child poverty, such as scrapping the two-child limit, scrapping the rape clause, scrapping the bedroom tax. Let's talk about these things. And let's also talk about renewables and how we boost Scotland's renewable potential. And let's talk about the Constitution, where we've got in a disagreement, but let's have that conversation. And I have to say, I've still not had the courtesy of even acknowledgement, let alone a response. It doesn't fill me with great hope that there's going to be much in the way of, certainly before an election, much in the way of collaboration with the Labour Party, but I'd be willing to do so on issues of domestic and international importance.
But yeah, and there was another really good question was, but are there not parallels between the sort of nationalist arguments for Scottish independence and the ones that were used in support of Brexit?
So the big differences for me there's a number of differences. First and foremost, it's really important that those who believe in independence like I do continue to approach the debate with honesty. So what you won't hear from me is, by the way, Max, we'll be independent tomorrow and there'll be a river of milk and honey, and by the way, we'll put £350 million on the side of a bus and we'll tell you you'll get that back every single week. Right? What we will do is we will be evidence-based and facts-based and equally be upfront about where the challenges are. So, for example, Scotland will face a deficit that we'll have to try to bring down. So we'll have to work within fiscal, make sure we're fiscally sustainable in that regard. We'll have to be really upfront about some of the points you've already made around, if we're in the European Union and the UK remains outside of the European Union, what does that mean around, for example, custom checks for goods? And we've talked about that in a recent paper as part of the series that I've mentioned already. But what we'll also be honest about is the massive opportunity that if Scotland had access to its oil and gas revenues, was able to, of course, unleash the potential of the net zero economy, particularly offshore wind, where we have massive potential, and we were able to carve our own path and our own future, then here's what we could achieve and could do. We're not trying to appeal to people's emotions. We're trying to, you know, and there's nothing wrong with doing that, actually, to some extent. But what we're trying to do is absolutely appeal to the evidence base. And I think those things that we were promised in 2014, we were promised if you vote no to independence, that's the only way to guarantee your membership of the European Union. And then what happened 2 years later? We were told, by the way, if you vote for opposing independence and for continued Westminster rule, then you'd have the broad shoulders of the EU's economy. And the UK's global influence, and look how those things have fallen apart. And we were told, when we warned, by the way, one day Boris Johnson might be Prime Minister, they said, whoa, complete and utter scare stories from those who believe in independence, and look where we ended up being. So, look, we'll do our best to always stick to the evidence basis. And at the same time, those emotional connections that people have to the United Kingdom, never downplaying them. You know, that important connection that people have who feel British, for example, who live in Scotland, we shouldn't ever downplay that. We should say, you know what, you should feel, you can absolutely feel British and still vote for independence. Because what we're not telling you to do is rip up that cultural and social union. What we're saying is, it's not better that we make decisions for ourselves and meet the needs and interests of the country and make those decisions in Scotland, as opposed to a country so many hundreds of miles away, that where Scotland often feels like a bit of an afterthought.
Another one of my does really well list, I think the fact that we have had so little issues with strikes in the way that, you know, certainly compared to England, that kind of consensual, let's get round a table and fix it together attitude is exactly what you want when you're dealing with industrial disputes.
Exactly, now, exactly. And I mean, there was an ASLEF guy on the TV, because there's some trade strikes coming up later on in April. And it, you know, he said, oh, we don't have any discussions going on in Scotland because, and we haven't, you know, they've been fine because it's because they talk to us.
With that's now been the case, not just with the rail workers, but also with the nurses, with the doctors. That is to do with attitude. But, and again, if you think about the whole attitude of the UK government to the devolved governments, is very macho, muscular, you know, we're in charge, do what we say. And if you take that attitude into any forum, including trade union negotiations, all you're going to do is get people's backs up and create, you know,
impasses. I know. Exactly. And just to take that point, a bit further on the, because it came out in one of the other questions from the LSE, was asked, you know, what would be the future of SNP once India is achieved? And, you know, will there be Labour and Tory in Scotland?
An excellent question about the future of the SNP and other political parties post-independence. Look, I think the SNP is a party, is the biggest party of independence. The main vehicle of independence post-independence will undoubtedly still continue to be the major political party in Scotland. I don't know what the position will be of the Conservative and Unionist Party post-independence, or Labour Party for that matter, but it's really healthy, of course, it is, almost goes without saying, really healthy to have a plurality of political parties of different opinions and different political traditions. So I think those parties will, in some way or another, continue, and there'll probably be new parties that will form and emerge as well. I suppose the point I'd make also is that upon a successful vote for independence, this maybe goes back to Max's question slightly, is one of the things I would be very keen for the SNP to do and the Scottish Government to do upon winning a referendum is making sure that we bring people who voted no and voted opposed independence as part of the team to help us to negotiate with the UK government. I think that's really important, and I think that's a mistake that was made by those who pursued Brexit. I think Brexit was a mistake, of course I do, but once the vote happened, the UK government at the time pushed for a hard Brexit, when actually what they could have done was bring those who opposed Brexit as part of a kind of Team UK approach to see how we negotiate with the European Union. I think that we should, in essence, the day after independence, bring those who opposed independence as part of, and say, look, we're now part of Team Scotland. We respect the vote of the people of Scotland. We're now part of Team Scotland. Let's go and let's advise those who are negotiating with the UK government.
He doesn't say the words constitutional convention, but I reckon that was probably referencing that, and a constitutional convention, you know, would enable that sort of more, what's the word, consensual, isn't it? And he's saying, it well, is. After that, let's be as consensual as we can. And yeah. I just thought that was impressive.
It's excellent, and it's almost the anti-Brexit, isn't it? Because if you remember, exactly. That was just, you know, suck it up, you lost. You know, it's saying, right, okay, it might not have been the result you want, but this is the way we're going. Come and be part of designing it and pulling them back in. It is exactly the kind of approach that we will need. Yeah. I think recently that there is some stuff that he's either not explaining well enough or he's allowing to be made mischief with, and it's things like this: kick the Tories out. And this, the fact he's now talking about asking for another Section 30 order, now taken on their own as little bold statements, you can see why people get quite annoyed about them. And if you stop and either listen to a bit more of the conversation or think it through, they're not so bold and inflammatory.
You told delegates that this election actually is a fight between you and the Tories in most of Scotland. What about Labour?
Well, first of all, that's just an arithmetic reality, you know, that when it comes to most seats, they are either held by the Conservatives and the SNP is in second place, or indeed the SNP holds a seat.
But your main threat is Labour.
Now, what I would say is that there's a historic... I will come to Labour in a second, don't worry. But when it comes to the Conservatives, let me say this. Scotland has a real opportunity, historic opportunity, to ensure that we kick out every single Conservative MP out of Scotland, and they deserve nothing less. And the only way to do that is to vote for the SNP, because the SNP is second place in every single Conservative seat. When it comes to Labour, don't worry, we'll be taking the challenge to Labour. And the reason we'll be doing that is because Labour have aligned themselves with the same failing Westminster orthodoxy that has done us so much damage.
I think he maybe needs to somehow get better by not giving the other side ammunition that he doesn't have to give them.
That's true. And I mean, that one about Tory Free Scotland, what he said, it was clear when he was talking about it, he was talking about Tory MPs, but it wasn't reported like that. So it ends up with a lot of Tories saying, well, you don't think I'm leaving Scotland, or am I not wanted here? And actually, he just needs to learn to avoid that.
Yeah, well, where can mischief be made and try and nail it down first? I don't know that too nice is the right way of putting it, but the Michael Matheson thing, he didn't come across as very decisive, and I questioned his judgment in the way that played out. And I think it perhaps is difficult if you could also look at it and say, well, he's loyal and he's supportive of his people. But that made a more of a mess for him in the end. And if they'd just taken a sort of harder line up front and said, look, step down, it'll all go away, come back later. The fact that he kind of tried to back him up, I think, ended up doing both of them damage. And in the end, he lost his job anyway.
Let me ask you about Michael Matheson, your good friend. You described him as a man of integrity and honesty. That was after you knew what had happened with the iPad. Given what we now know, and given the findings of the report that was published last week, do you still believe him to be a man of integrity and honesty?
Look, Michael made a mistake. There's no ifs, buts, or maybes about that. And decent people can make mistakes. I mean, if there's somebody out there who's lived a saintly life that's completely unblemished, then so be it. But Michael has made a mistake. He's paid the price for that, literally paid back all of the money, of course, and he'll obviously now be referred to the Parliament Standards Committee, who will then decide to make a judgment, and I won't interfere in that process. So Michael made a mistake, and not only that, of course, he also lost his job in government, and he's paying a price for that. So look, decent people can make mistakes, Martin.
You know, you could imagine, if he knew what had actually happened, you could imagine then... Well, he does want to back him up.
Yeah.
But then what that means is that, of course, what goes on is that it gets completely blown out of all proportion in the media. And then he seems to be, he isn't maybe actually, but he seems to be backing up someone who has made a real mess of it. Mm-hmm. And Matheson did make a mess of it. Yeah, I think maybe that was just kind of inexperience, really. And maybe trying to be loyal, but not quite being hard-edged enough.
The way that council tax freeze suddenly appeared to be just thrown in at conference and seemed to undo a lot of good work that had been done with the Veritas agreement and the councils, because it took them all by surprise. There was something weird going on there.
We're committed to fundamentally reforming local taxation. We'll re-energise our work to do just that. We have consulted on what level the council tax should be next year. At conference, we have listened and we have reached our decision. I can announce to the people of Scotland that next year your council tax will be frozen.
So that seemed to take the councils by surprise and thus undermined the Verity House agreement, but it also seemed to take the Greens by surprise and thus undermined the Bute House agreement.
The announcement of the council tax freeze was certainly very frustrating in the nature of how that was announced. It is absolutely the Scottish Greens' position that the council tax freeze is not a good policy, and we now need to work together to ensure that councils are properly funded.
The hate crime stuff, again, is that sort of, if it had been handled differently, could a lot of the heat have been taken out of it first, or was it inevitable it was going to be used like that?
Very proud of the Hate Crime Act. We have seen, I'm afraid, not just in the UK, of course Scotland, but right across many parts of the world, this kind of rising tide of hatred against people because of their protected characteristics. And Scotland, having this hate crime legislation, protecting people, giving them that protection from hatred, while at the same time protecting people in terms of the freedom of expression, for me ensures that we've got a piece of legislation that will be enacted and implemented in a way that is absolutely balanced, make sure it absolutely protects people and their freedom of expression, but guards people from, as I say, that rising tide of hatred we've seen far too often in our society.
The Police Federation represent the people who are going to be having to enforce this law. They say it's a recipe for disaster. Is it?
I couldn't disagree more, I'm afraid. If you hear what the Chief Constable has to say, of course, there has been appropriate training in place, but also the police officers have been dealing with hatred for many, many decades and been doing it very sensibly indeed. Let's take the new offences, the stirring up offences that have been the focus of a lot of discourse and discussion. They've been in existence since 1986 in terms of racial stirring up offence of hatred. I believe that the new offences that have been created, they will be policed in again a very similar way, policed sensibly. And of course, the police deal with vexatious complaints on probably a daily basis, and therefore will undoubtedly, if there are vexatious complaints, be able to deal with that in a way that again is sensible. This bill is about protecting people against that rising tide of hatred we see far too prevalent in our society nowadays.
But what lots of people are saying is that this is going to radically increase the number of vexatious complaints that the police are going to have to deal with, and they're already not able to cope with the demands being placed on their resources. Is policing Twitter spats really the best use of their time and energy?
Well, firstly, there is absolutely no evidence for that claim whatsoever. And secondly, the police deal with vexatious complaints every single day on a whole range of legislative, a whole range of legislation. They deal with those vexatious complaints effectively and sensibly. Let's not take away from the fact we've got a Hate Crime Act in place, implemented in force, because there is far too much hatred in our society. And often those who are the first ones to criticise the Act are also the first ones to tell me they have a zero-tolerance approach to hatred. So now we've got an Act in place, has appropriate freedom of expression safeguards, but also protects people from hatred. It's an Act that everybody should get behind.
There are lots of concerns online about the impact it will have on freedom of speech, and there are lists being circulated amongst some activists on Twitter today of accounts to monitor. There's lots of concerns that people will be targeted. Is that something that you recognise?
The only concern you should have when it comes to the new stirring up of hate, the new stirring up offences, is if your behaviour is threatening or abusive and intends to stir up hatred. And by the way, even if that is the case, there are some defences such as the reasonable person defence and so on and so forth. So unless your behaviour is threatening or abusive and intends to stir up hatred, then you have nothing to worry about in terms of the new offences being created. If your behaviour is threatening or abusive and does intend to stir up hatred against Jews or Muslims or disabled people or gay people, then I think the law should protect those people who are the victims of that potential hatred. And I think that's really important. So whether what's happening online or Twitter lists that are being created, all of that, frankly, is irrelevant. What is relevant is the threshold for criminality which will apply in terms of the Act that's coming into force.
But the row around people like J.K. Rowling saying that they're not being hateful, they're not being hateful, but what they're saying is being interpreted as hate. That's the problem, is that who decides what is hateful and what isn't?
Well, who decides what is hateful in terms of criminal law is who has always decided what is hateful in terms of criminal law. That is the police, who then provide a report to the Crown and Procurator Fiscal Service. If there is a sufficiency of evidence to charge, the Crown will do that. It is not Twitter police, it is not activists, it is not the media, it is not, thank goodness, even politicians who decide ultimately whether or not a crime has been committed. It will be the police to investigate and the Crown. And the threshold for criminality is incredibly high. In fact, it's higher in the new starting up offences than the racial starting up offence, which has existed without controversy since 1986.
Now, this isn't the only bit of legislation to come under attack from those who would like to attack the Scottish Government. And we saw the same thing happen with the deposit return scheme and the GRA bill, both of which, to be fair, went through before Humza became First Minister. But he was First Minister when decisions were taken whether to fight back against Westminster's interference or not. And they chose not to fight back on the deposit return scheme, which I kind of thought, well, you know, you had all the equipment in there, you had all the contracts in place. Could you not just have provided the recycling service, even if we didn't have the deposit bit? It would still have been halfway towards being a scheme. That was a scheme with a lot of public backing, not least from people who've seen them working all across Europe and think, what a fantastic idea. Why can't we have this? But they backed down on that one. And the GRA, which didn't appear to have a lot of popular support, and yet that's the one that they chose to take the UK government to court over and lost. And Alistair Jack even got the opportunity to extract maximum humiliation by forcing the Scottish government to pay the cost of the action as well. So again, there's a question for me about judgment and picking your battles.
Well, two examples of where legislation has been stymied by interference by Alistair Jack.
Yes.
So you can have an opinion one way or another about whether you think those bits of legislation are good or well drawn up or whatever, but probably that there is a question there about how well they were dealt with.
Yes.
And how well the Scottish Government responded to the criticism, and then how well or not that they responded to the fact that they were stymied by a sudden, by Alistair Jack deciding to be the Governor General of Scotland and saying, "Now you can't."
In the same way as they used the Internal Market Act to stymie the deposit return scheme, the same thing has happened. The Muirburn and Wildlife Management Act that we were just pleased has gone through Holyrood. They've taken one little bit of it about glue traps, which is a way of trapping rodents and is apparently not a nice way to, you know, it's cruel. And this, what the Scottish Government has voted to do is to outlaw the sale of them in Scotland, to ban the sale of them. And they've come along and said, no, you can't ban the sale of them. Yes. It's still illegal to use them and possess them, which arguably you do if you then buy one. But it's another of these, it's muscular unionism trying to slap Holyrood down.
So I think that's the good examples of asking a question. Is Scottish Government headed up by Humza, right? So is the Scottish Government good enough? And fleet, again, we're using this term again, aren't we? Fleet of foot enough to be able to get the best possible outcome from that kind of interference, but also make the best use of it as a bit of pro-indie propaganda,
yes,
pro-indie
exactly.
You know, argument. We're saying, look, are you really happy with this kind of interference? And I think there's some people that do that, there's some people that do that quite well, but ScotGov as a whole doesn't seem to me. I'm often a bit frustrated with them. I think, oh, come on, get out there and be a bit more, you know, argumentative back. Be a bit more combative out there when you're doing a news programme, when you're doing an interview, you know. Make it clear, actually. Be a bit more, I don't know, be a bit more
gallus.
Yes, that's it. Be a bit, exactly. Be a bit more gallus, be a bit more kind of upfront and going, you know, and get people would get behind that, I think.
Yeah. We've been sort of up until now more or less comparing him with Sturgeon's approach, but actually that's one where you think, how would Alex Salmond have dealt with those things?
Yes, exactly.
And it's sort of to do with the confidence of the government in standing up to an aggressor. And that is how you would describe Westminster with the way the approach they're taking.
Well, probably, Alex Salmond was definitely gallus.
Yes,
Alex
indeed.
Salmond was and probably still is definitely gallus. Yeah.
I've got one good bit left. It's to do with his role as first activist. And I think the fact he's been on the stage at the Believe in Scotland marches, he's going to be the next one. That's fabulous. That is him standing up and talking independence and following through on it.
What a beautiful crowd you are. Far beyond the eye can even see. Friends, the opposition who sit in that chamber in Holyrood, they tell me that we are narrow nationalists. Well, I look at this crowd and I see people of all ethnicities and races. I see people who are religious. I see the agnostic and the atheist. I see the Highlander and the Lowlander. I see those from the cities and those from the islands. I see those who are straight and gay, lesbian, bisexual. I see our trans community. I see them all here. I see our movement. I see our movement in its most beautiful diversity, the beautiful tapestry of our nation. And I'm reminded of the words of my mentor, the late and great Bashir Ahmed, who said, it doesn't matter where you come from. What matters is where we're going together as a nation. And I can tell you now, I know where we are going together as a nation. Our destination as an independent nation, and of course an independent nation in the very heart of the European Union, where we belong.
I know you were thinking, you know, those independence building. What is it called? Building a better Scotland?
Building a new Scotland. See, we don't even know what they're called. That's how interesting they are.
So you were saying that set of papers that have come out, which we think is called Building a Better Scotland. It's something like that. They're pretty dry. I mean, they're very detailed. They've got some good points in them, but they're pretty dry. And so I suppose we're sort of saying, yeah, great. That's kind of load of background information that people could refer to. But we need to have a much more, I don't know, responsive, fluid, upfront way of talking about those things. Because yes, it just puts folk off, really. I mean, it even puts you and me off going and reading
exactly.
It. And we're quite likely to go.
We're geeks when it comes to this kind of thing.
We will go and do that.
It's great that we know where the detail is if we want to go and check it, but something that brings it to life in words, you know, nice, I don't want to say side of a bus type phrases, but, you know, things that
definitely
resonate
not
more with
the bus phrases. We do not want side of a bus phrases.
No, we don't want side of a bus type anything, really. I don't even think buses should have sides. Yes, that was my list. So I think if I was to sum it up, I would say he's doing better than I thought he would, and there's a few areas, if he could just get them cracked, I think he could be really quite good.
I think he's actually probably doing better than I thought as well. I mean, I always thought, God, it's such a hard act to follow. I mean, Nicola Sturgeon, you know, had her faults, and she had her faults as a leader, but she did a really rattling good job. So it was it's always a hard job to follow someone like that. You're sort of stepping into their shoes. So I think, you know, he's probably done better than I was thought he might. And I think, well, I'm kind of still holding back a little bit until I just see how he's going to set up the SNP to run this general election campaign. Because that's his first big.
That's the big test.
That's the big test, really. I mean, and let's see how that goes. And maybe we could come back after the general election, however it turns out, and we can do another, a bit of a resume of how he did.
We could. Let's think about doing that.
He makes a joke at one point with, it's in the LSE one.
If only we could grow the economy at the same speed as we ever-growing list of middle-aged men that are hosting podcasts, we'd be on to a real winner.
Middle-aged men and deciding that they're going to, you know, tell the world what they think about everything, and they just suddenly they become podcasters. So I thought, I'm still on the stage on Saturday, I might turn and say, well, just to let you know, a Scottish independent podcast is run by women. And
yes,
we're not middle-aged, we're way past that.
Come and talk to us.
Come and talk to us.
Give it a go, you never know.
Yeah.
Well, I hope you enjoyed listening to me and Marlene mulling over.
Quite good, mulling over.
Yeah. Mulling over Humza's first year. We're not actually going to give him a score, our marks out of 10. But yes, we'll come back. We'll watch with interest and let us know what you think. If you want us to do more of this kind of thing, you know, we could always give it a thought.